previously.
There's a lot of different things that can affect a man's ability to produce sperm. Smoking, environmental toxins.
If a guy decides to stop smoking today, well, that's terrific. You know, and certainly everybody should stop smoking immediately or as soon as they can and have the willpower to make that decision. But the lingering effects are still going to be present for months.
This is Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Welcome to Beyond the Birds and the Bees. I'm Thomas Fawn, and with me is Natalie Berger. And we're both physicians with the Texas Fertility Center. And we bring you this hour every Saturday at noon to talk about fertility, difficulty conceiving, and how to increase the chances of conceiving. Our group was begun in 1980, so we've been around a long time. This has been a well-established practice of reproductive endocrinologist.
Hi, I'm Dr. Natalie Berger. Again, I'm here with Dr. Thomas Fawn, and there are actually two other physicians in our practice as well, too, Drs. Lisa Hansard and Dr. Kaylin Silverberg. We actually operate out of two offices currently. We have our main location on 6500 Mopac Expressway, and we have another new location right across the street from Round Rock Hospital. So we're excited to talk to you today again about the issues of fertility and infertility and bring some light to a lot of the darkness that may cloud the air. So we really want to be available to you and be open in terms of questions and answers.
We're going to try to bring some light into questions that have always come up among our patients that have talked with us, primarily misconceptions. Now, also, I'd like for you to realize that there is a website for our practices, txfertility.com, and there's a wealth of material on that website. If you have further questions, or tune in next week because we will continue this on a weekly basis. Also, around town, you may see a promotion for fertility awareness. There's nothing funny about infertility. This is no joke. More information is at increaseyourchances.org, but you may see this promotion about awareness for the birds and the bees today in several locations. There's a group right now at the paddle boat rental at Town Lake. At 3 o'clock, these two individuals will be in the 2nd Street Warehouse District, and this evening at 6:30 at the Dell Diamond. There's a lot of information out there. Unfortunately, there's also some misinformation. And what we would like to do is talk a little bit about those. When we meet with patients in the office, we're asked many questions, some of which are wives' tales, some of which are promoted as actually being very truthful and honest over the Internet. So we'd kind of like to be sure that everyone understands that not all that you read is true. One of the things that I'm asked about a lot from many patients is the concept of go home and relax. And I can tell you, I'm sure Dr. Berger will agree, most of our patients are pretty stressed by this, and we all have stress in our daily life. And patients are wanting to get this problem solved. So to tell them to go home and relax probably only makes it worse.
And it's true. A lot of times this can come from family or friends that are well-meaning. But unfortunately, the way that it comes across to the couple that's trying to conceive is very stressful and adds to their stress and their burden, their feelings of inadequacy. And so to really, you know, try to dispel this certainly as a myth that simply relaxing, simply not thinking about it, these kinds of things aren't helpful in terms of treating fertility problems. And again, even though they're well-meaning comments made by well-meaning friends and family, we should be very careful about making such comments to couples who are really struggling, having a lot of stress with the fertility process.
You just won't believe how many patients will say that they're receiving advice from their friends. And a lot of times it will be things that are said that aren't really helpful, like, all I had to do was look at my husband and I became pregnant. Well, I bet something else happened. But anyway, that isn't very helpful, as you might expect. They're trying to say something. They don't really know what to say. and invariably they wind up saying the wrong thing. In fact, my advice to individuals who have friends that are struggling with this is just listen. And then maybe they can seek advice from a professional, and particularly to look for a formally trained reproductive endocrinologist. I think that's where you get the majority of the factual information.
And it's certainly understandable, with fertility being such a private process and people really trying to find a lot of information on their own before seeking formal evaluation, it's certainly understandable that they would be seeking information from their friends and family sometimes. Certainly the internet, which provides a very anonymous type of source information. But it can be very difficult and even sort of dangerous to read a lot of these sources of information on the internet and really apply it to your own situation, because you don't know the full details about what any individual on the internet has undergone in terms of fertility. You don't know their background. You know very little about their total experience. And so really to try and take with a grain of salt some of the information that you hear about on blogs, on the internet. I do like the fact that the internet, you know, does provide a more private support network, and I think that's really important in terms of people feeling connected, because people don't necessarily want to share some of this information with their close family and friends. It can be very helpful to have that support network on the internet, but to be careful in terms of the information that you're gleaning from that. We certainly hear it all the time that people come in like, My friend, you know, in California is on this certain regimen, and she got pregnant on the first try of IVF. Why aren't we doing this here? And clinics work differently. Doctors evaluate things differently. You cannot necessarily transfer one treatment process to another individual. So just to be careful about the information, again, that you're gleaning from the internet. And understandably, also, too, people are wanting to not seek formal evaluation sometimes because they want to try to fix things themselves. And that certainly is very reasonable to a point. But we, again, do want to create understanding and make sure people are getting factual information about fertility and infertility.
Yeah, I think that's really important, Natalie. And I think one of the things that to keep in mind is if you do go to the internet, look for a website that is peer-reviewed. That means been written by physicians that are formally trained in infertility, like what I mentioned with our website, txfertility.com. If you forget it, you can call our office at 451-0149. Try to get information from a really good source. Our national organization is called American Society for Reproductive Medicine. It's asrm.org. So try to do that. I just think that will just make things so much easier whenever you really understand the truth. You know, Natalie, I had a patient in, several years ago that is kind of interesting. The newspaper had called me because this woman had put an ad in the classified saying that she wanted to adopt a baby. And so the newspaper put it out, didn't think about it, looked back at it and thought, this is really interesting. So they actually contacted the woman. And the woman said, yes, I'd like to adopt a baby. And she talked for a few minutes. And then actually she kind of broke down and she said, I really don't want to adopt a baby. I want to become pregnant. And all my friends said if I'd go out and adopt, I would become pregnant.
Yes.
And so it was kind of interesting. So the paper called and said, so how much does it increase your chances to become pregnant if you adopt? Well, it turns out the facts are the people that adopt have actually a lower chance of conceiving, not because that's a negative thing, just because they probably quit treatments or they quit seeking the answers to their problems. And clearly the data does not support that if you go out and adopt that you become pregnant. However, if you go out and adopt and do become pregnant, it is just great conversation. That's what everyone talks about.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of questions about other literature, like when patients ask you about any kind of particular books or other sources of information besides the internet, is there anything particularly that you refer them to? Or
well, there's several books that are out, and I'm sure they will see them, particularly as they're in bookstores. But actually, in some of these books, I've asked them to ask us the questions about them, because not all the books are written by formally trained reproductive endocrinologists. Also, it's real important to talk about some what people can do to kind of improve their chances of becoming pregnant, because I think that some people get sort of misconceptions about what's harmful, what's not harmful. For instance, I had a patient who said, well, my husband smokes, I don't smoke, and therefore there shouldn't be any detrimental effect. After all, I, the woman, is the person getting pregnant. And it really is not true. It's true. It is detrimental for men to smoke, to sperm, and even sperm function. Remember, when guys do sperm counts and they count the number of sperm and the number moving, that doesn't say that they function properly. So that's one of the things that we try to get our patients to understand, that really any kind of smoke, even secondhand smoke, has been shown to decrease the chances of conceiving. We need to get them completely away from that.
So basically, you know, during our discussion here, we also want to say that if you have any questions, feel free to give us a call at 390-1370. Again, that's 390-1370. And we're talking about the birds and bees and misconceptions about conception.
Excuse me, Natalie. I just wanted to remind everyone that about the awareness, the costume bird and bee couple will be hitting the streets. And don't forget that you may run into them at 3 o'clock on 2nd Street in the Warehouse District and 6:30 at the Dell Diamond.
So it's interesting we talk about infertility. I think that some of the couples that are most struck by the news that they're having problems are those couples who have initially conceived without issue, and then when they're trying for their second or the third child are all of a sudden having major obstacles. Do you have a sense, actually, in terms of like what percentage of your patients that you see fall into this, quote, secondary infertility category? Because it can be very stressful and sort of shocking when it's been so easy before.
I agree with you completely. And it's interesting because patients come in, and whatever their situation is, they say it's so frustrating. I mean, those that have never conceived before are really frustrated, but those that seem to have conceived easily and now can't conceive have their own frustration. And I try to tell every patient, everyone is frustrated for different reasons in your own situation. I will say that the majority of patients I see have not had a baby. Some have conceived. And I think it's important to realize we not only see couples who have trouble conceiving, but couples who have trouble carrying a pregnancy. So we evaluate couples who have recurrent miscarriage as well. So even though over half of the patients that I've seen have never had a baby, there are significant portions that have had the population that have had babies and then struggle with their second one. And it can be, you start all over, basically. It can be any of the causes that we look at for patients who've never had a baby before. In fact, even if we saw a couple and we went through their evaluation, helped them become pregnant, and they come back and can't get pregnant again, we kind of start all over with the evaluation. And we'll talk in much more detail about that later, but you start over with repeating the sperm count and repeating everything else. Because if something could have happened to the woman over the last 3 or 4 years, something could have happened to the man.
Another thing, we know that in general, infertility tends to target women who are getting older, meaning from a fertility age, getting older, of course, in the mid, late 30s and early 40s. But we still occasionally do see people even in their 20s or early 30s. So fertility or infertility does not always respect your age. And we know that certain issues, especially fallopian tube problems or certain sperm problems, can be just as common in a younger or an older population. So if it's been more than a year and you are less than 35, or if you're over the age of 35 and it's been more than 6 months, it's certainly very reasonable to seek evaluation. If nothing else, talk to your OBGYN or the other provider doing your annual examinations, but also to consider a fertility specialist who is specifically trained in fertility issues.
I think that's really important. Age is one of the most difficult things to overcome in women. And also, even though guys don't seem to have the dramatic decline in fertility, there is a decline in fertility as they get older.
That's great. So in terms of other things, just, you know, we'll be talking in the next segment a little more about the misconceptions about conception again, and specifically talking about important things like what, you know, where do we start having troubles getting people pregnant? We know that there is a lot of people in the media out there getting pregnant at a very advanced age, seemingly easily, and we need to talk about that a little bit more into detail. So that's a really important topic for our next segment in just a moment. Hi, this is Dr. Natalie Berger. I'm here with Dr. Thomas Vaughn, and we are two of the four physicians at Texas Fertility Center. We're talking today about misconceptions about conception. And we'll start talking in just a moment, but I want to remind everyone about the call-in number because we are live today. The call-in number is 390-1370. Again, 390-1370. And we're going to talk about some misconceptions again. So one thing I started talking about before the break was this discussion about sort of how long do we have to wait until we can start fertility treatments. I think that there is a lot of misinformation out there about people getting pregnant at a very advanced age. In Hollywood and media elsewhere, there are seemingly easy pregnancies occurring to women in their 40s and 50s. And I think that a lot of people have this conception that if we just do IVF, we can overcome great and significant problems with the ovaries because we can just pound them with more hormones. And the unfortunate truth is people are not really describing the fact that a lot of these pregnancies are not occurring with the individual's own eggs. We know that if we're using donor eggs in a scenario where we have a woman who's even in her 40s or even early 50s, we can accomplish very high success rates because the eggs themselves are young. And so we know that when we have patients coming in their early, mid-40s and are sort of stunned to find that they actually have decreased ovarian function, it may be in part due to the fact that you open up a People magazine, you see yet another singer or actress having twins at 46 and not really understanding the fact that it's not just IVF, it's not just aggressive hormones that we're giving. We're actually a lot of times using donor eggs, a lot of times anonymously, to accomplish these pregnancies in the mid-40s, late-40s, and early-50s.
That's so important, Natalie, because when these women in their mid-40s, like you suggest, are talked about 46 years of age, if she had undergone IVF with her own eggs, the chance of her having a baby is less than 5%. If she uses a younger egg, the chance of having a baby could be as high as 70 to 75%. So that's real important. And unfortunately, not everyone tells the truth that is high profile, like an actress that gets into People magazine and leaves the impression that it was her own eggs. And we understand their need for privacy, but it is misleading to our patients. So it's a real misconception, again, that it should be just as easy in your mid-40s if you just utilize in vitro fertilization. Remember, in vitro fertilization is to remove the egg from the body, get it fertilized, and put it back. If the woman's ovaries have quit making eggs or there's no eggs left, then the in vitro fertilization process will not help. So it's not the end all, particularly when there's not any oocytes. Women are born with all their eggs, and once they're gone, they're gone. Men make sperm all the time. They make 3,000 sperm, and every one of them is very proud of it. But remember, women are born with all their eggs, and therefore we need to utilize those before they become so old that they won't give us a baby. And to make matters worse, unfortunately, when women do conceive, their chance of losing the pregnancy increases significantly. So it's a compounding negative effect. I know it's not fair. It is biology, so just keep it in mind.
Another thing that, you know, oftentimes we hear from our patients during examination or even in discussion is that their doctor has told them that they have a tipped uterus, and does this increase their chance of fertility problems? And pretty much everyone has a tipped uterus one way or the other. It tends to tip either forward or less frequently backwards. And even the people who it tips backwards for, that does not have any influence on fertility. The sperm, if they're moving well, are, quote, smart enough to get where they need to go. So having a tipped uterus does not cause fertility problems and is not an indication for any kind of surgery or procedure or such.
I think that's real important also because so many times patients will ask the question, but there also are physicians who may have told the patient, because of the tilted uterus, that you may have a harder time getting pregnant. Now, where that came from in the old days is that it turns out that women are likely, more likely to have endometriosis as they delay childbearing. With endometriosis, it can make the uterus become tilted. And therefore, the physicians put this together that the gynecologist at that time, if the uterus is tilted, that you may have an increased chance of difficulty in conceiving. Remember, that may be true, but if you were to look inside the abdomen, do a laparoscope, and there is no disease, then the fact that the uterus is tilted does not increase the problems of infertility at all. So we kind of look at it like some people are right-handed and some people are left-handed. So if there's no disease process, it is not a factor at all.
Speaking of right and left, a lot of people have the conception that women ovulate on the right side, then the left side, then the right side, then the left side. And this is actually not the case. Even though it would be nice from a process standpoint to have things so predictable, women do not necessarily go back and forth from the right to left ovaries each successive month during ovulation. So it's not something that we can totally predict from month to month which side or which ovary will be releasing the important egg.
And that becomes really important if a woman is missing a fallopian tube, for instance. So her really only chance of getting pregnant is on one given side, say on the right side. So it's kind of nice to know if she's ovulating from the right side. And as Dr. Berger said, it is not an alternating process. It is a random phenomenon. That means that it can be either one each month. Remember, think about it like flipping a coin. If you flip heads, you're not necessarily going to get tails the next month. You may have heads three times in a row and then tails twice. It's a random phenomenon. So that's a real important concept.
And one thing that comes up not infrequently is this concept of Robitussin being used to improve cervical mucus. And I was wondering if you, Dr. Vaughn, would be able to mention a little bit more about that.
Yes, I think it is really popular. And what happened was in 10, 15, maybe 18 years or so ago, there was some sort of flu outbreak or some viral illness in Pennsylvania. And a family physician was giving everyone Robitussin for it. And then the patients happened to have been, after that period of time, going in, doing their fertility treatment, and cervical mucus was being evaluated. And there was this observation that the mucus looked better. And then the conclusion that the reason the mucus looked better was because of the Robitussin. And the Robitussin, which was used to clear up nasal mucus, may have affected cervical mucus. And, of course, that was shown to not be the case. And for anyone who followed the protocol, you would take 2 teaspoons of Robitussin 4 times a day. It's almost enough to make you gag. It's so sweet. And, you know, this is another interesting area, too, and that deals with cervical mucus. And this was real popular, particularly in the 70s, where couples would have intercourse around ovulation. The woman was rushed into the office to have the cervix evaluated, the mucus withdrawn from the cervix to see if there were sperm moving in the cervical mucus. It turns out that a physician in Canada named Collins was able to look back at all the infertility patients that were in the Canadian system because it was on a computer and it's a nationalized healthcare, so he could get this information. And he went back and looked at all the patients that had gone through that part of the procedure but quit their treatment. In other words, they never pursued anything else like insemination or fertility drugs or anything, and looked back to see how many conceived and what their cervical mucus test revealed. And he broke it into there was no sperm in the mucus, there was sperm but not moving, to a few moving, to a lot moving, and the pregnancy rates were actually equal in all categories. There was no statistical difference in those. So it's been at least 18 or 20 years since we've done a postcoital test at the Texas Fertility Center.
Luckily, I mean, that's sort of an awkward and embarrassing test for people. So it's a good thing that we've been able to show that there's really not any benefit for that test and really focus on other more important factors influencing fertility. And, you know, just as a sort of general note, I hear not infrequently as well, too, that a lot of patients don't want to come forward to a fertility specialist because they perceive treatment as all being expensive. And there's this general perception that a lot of clinics or most clinics only do IVF or in vitro fertilization, And in our clinic, that's simply not the case. We know that actually the majority of things that we do are not IVF. We have a lot of different factors to explore, a lot of different treatments to consider in a variety of patients. Now, if someone has absent fallopian tubes or very few sperm, it's true that IVF or in vitro fertilization may be the most reasonable option. But for a lot of people, there are different things to consider. For instance, looking at things like endometriosis, can we use more modest treatments like artificial insemination with oral medication for women to achieve pregnancy? And so really, we try to give the couples as many options as we have and really let them know what are your projected success rates and what are the pros and cons of each treatment that we have. We also realize that if the woman has other symptoms such as painful periods, irregular cycles, that at least in the diagnostic part, we can also use those diagnoses for medical reasons and treat certain things medically. Not everything that we do is a fertility diagnosis. Also, the fact that, you know, people are concerned about the multiple rate. Yes, it's true that a lot of things that we do increase the chances of multiples, but there are certain strategies that we use to really try to control that. We know that certain medications, for instance, injectable hormones, do have a more potent effect on the ovaries and can lead to a higher chance of twins or more. But really our focus is trying to achieve the healthiest, safest pregnancy. And for us, that means a singleton pregnancy. We know that we have a lot more control in IVF than in other than some other treatments, but really overall, we are trying to give the couple the best chance for having a successful pregnancy.
Yeah, I think that's really, really an important point. And it turns out that at TFC, Texas Fertility Center, in vitro fertilization is probably about 25% to 30% of what we do. So we do many other things. And all these other options are sometimes very helpful, and couples don't really have to go to in vitro fertilization. There are certain situations where it is the only option, but keep in mind that there may be things that are less technical that can be done.
And again, I'll just mention our number is 390-1370 for anybody who has any questions about misconceptions about conception. And
I was just going to say, we talked a little bit earlier about some of the lifestyle changes that can be made to improve the chances of conceiving. And I think it's important to realize that there's a potential of anything that you put into your body that could have an adverse effect. For instance, it's real popular, I think, in Austin to use herbal medications. And some of them may be very good. The problem is that they're not pharmaceutical. Like if a physician gives you a prescription for ampicillin, you know it's ampicillin and there's nothing else in it. Unfortunately, when you get an herbal medication, you actually may have something else in it, and that may have an adverse effect. It's not that it was given to you as a patient maliciously, it's just that it was unknown what was in it because it's not from a pharmacy or pharmaceutical. So kind of keep that in mind as well. I remember one woman who really needed to increase her estrogen level in her blood. She took an herbal medicine. She didn't realize it had progesterone in it as well. And actually, progesterone before ovulation acts as a contraceptive. So that was a real disappointment. So keep that in mind also.
And one last thing to mention before we go to break in a moment. In terms of intercourse frequency, we know that there are some couples who feel that they should be having intercourse every single day to achieve pregnancy. And while that may be good for other reasons, and certainly not to take away from personal enjoyment, it's certainly not that necessary to have intercourse that frequently. And we know that having intercourse really timed around the fertile period, which we can discuss a little bit more again in the next segment, intercourse in that fertile period, like every other day, should be adequate for most couples to succeed in pregnancy. So we'll be going to break in just a moment, but again, if you have any questions, feel free to give us a call at 390-1370, and we'll be talking a little bit more about the targeted fertile period, when to have sex.
Talk Radio, 1370 AM.
Welcome back. This is Talk Radio 1370 and the hour of Beyond the Birds and the Bees with Dr. Natalie Berger and Thomas Vaughn. Natalie, right before we had to go to break, you were talking about how couples should think about frequency of intercourse if they're trying to conceive and it's around the fertile time of ovulation.
Right, and something that Dr. Hanser touched on last week, but I really wanted to go over it again because it is such an important factor. We know that most women, though not all, have some regularity to their periods, somewhere between every 21 to 35 days. So even though the most common interval is about a 28-day interval, it can certainly vary from woman to woman. And we know that ovulation typically occurs about 14 days from the start of the next period. So if you have a 28-day cycle, then ovulation is probably occurring around day 14. Conversely, if you have a 35-day cycle, you're probably ovulating as late as day 21. And if you have a short cycle, such as a 24-day cycle on average, you may be ovulating as early as day 10. And you know, one thing that Dr. Silberg brought up last week, which was a pretty easy way to look at things, was take the average number of days in your cycle, subtract 17, and start having sex every other day for, let's say, a week. That really should target your most fertile period. That should cover you in terms of having intercourse and getting some sperm there even before the egg comes, as well as having sperm there during that time too. And every other day, again, for most individuals, should be fine. If you want to have sex every day, for a lot of people that works out fine, but do not feel the stress of needing to do that. And the other thing is, if you want to even more finely pinpoint where the intercourse might be most helpful for fertility, you may consider using an ovulation kit. And the ovulation kit that we tend to talk about, especially for couples who are having any issues using a standard one that they find in the pharmacy, would be the Clear Blue Easy Kit. It gives you a very black and white response, which is very helpful when you are trying to really figure out where you are in terms of the lines. Is your line darker, lighter, same as the other line? Some of the other ovulation kits can require more interpretation and be more difficult for people to use. So if you're having any questions, using the Clear Blue Easy Kit can really be helpful in terms of targeting ovulation. And that kit will typically turn positive the day before you ovulate. So it can really fine-tune, again, where it is that you should be having intercourse.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And, you know, interestingly, by the time people get to us, they've tried all of these different frequencies of intercourse, making the husband save it up for a week, and all these sorts of things. You know, the bottom line, I think, is that usually if you've been sexually active for 6 to 12 months and you haven't conceived, this is not about sex. This is not about a different position. We don't want to hear about that. But all those sorts of things, it's probably that things aren't connecting, so to speak, and that's why it's worthwhile being seen. For couples that tend to have intercourse 2 or 3 times a week just naturally, then they have it covered, so to speak. For those that either from work or whatever choose to have intercourse once every week or two, then these little ovulation predictor kits are very helpful. And the kit tells a woman she is going to ovulate probably within 24 hours. The really good thing about that is that that's something prospective or something in advance so that you can plan on that. It's better than the old days of the body, basal body temperature, where you looked at your temperature change, and when it went up, then you said, yes, I ovulated 3 days ago. Did we have intercourse or not? So that's not very helpful because it's retrospective. It's looking back at the past. And also some studies have shown that it varies from woman to woman. When the temperature drops and then goes up, it may be 2 or 3 days before she ovulates. So it's very, very inaccurate. So I think it is important to kind of keep those things in mind.
Yeah, I hear it all the time, people coming in with their 5 or 6, 8 months of their basal body temperature charting and appearing really stressed about it. And I think it's totally fine for people to do if they are simply interested in sort of knowing what their overall temperature does throughout the cycle. But there certainly are other ways, and I think easier ways, to really target what's going on. So if you feel like you want to do those temperature charts, great. But if it's really getting very burdensome, it's hard to take temperature at the same time in the morning, you have a very erratic schedule, you're sick, whatever. There are so many things that can influence that temperature chart, and it really, there are easier ways to accomplish getting that information.
Natalie, I heard Dr. Silverberg tell one of his patients that take your thermometer, put it on the shelf, and when you get sick, if you want to take your temperature, take your temperature.
Right, right.
And not use it for fertility. And I think that's really good advice because this is stressful enough and having to be tied to a temperature chart, which means you're going to take your temperature before you get out of bed and do anything, is just one more stress to a very stressful situation. You know, as individuals, we may grow up thinking we may not be president of the United States, we may not be a very wealthy person, but getting pregnant is kind of almost entitled. And it's just like having arms and legs or whatever. And so therefore, when we have trouble with that, that becomes even much more frustrating. And then couples look around and they see things on television where babies are being abused, people don't want their children, and it's just like rubbing salt in the wound. So it's just a very, very stressful time, and we need to keep that in mind as well.
And on another note, it's certainly not uncommon for us when we see couples, we certainly talk to both men and women, to really elucidate, is there any factor in either person's history that would really bring up a possible cause for infertility? Certainly, male factor is a very common thing that we see. Independently, it probably influences about 20 to 30% of our cases. And there are multiple more cases where there is sort of a combined male and female factor. And one thing that we hear about sometimes is that, well, my sample seems to be a very good amount. Like, there doesn't seem to be any kind of issue in terms of the volume of the semen sample or thickness. And we know that that has no correlation with the sperm count, that the only way to really know if we have a good enough number of moving sperm is to either do a semen analysis, or pregnancy can tell us that things have worked. But there is no other good way to look at the sperm sample or do some of these over-the-counter tests, which I know people have been using, to really get a good idea as to what's going on with the sperm.
It's kind of interesting. You know, women usually only ovulate one egg, and yet in the ejaculate, there may be in normal samples 40 to 50 million sperm. And you wonder, why do there have to be so many? I mean, part of it is the typical guy thing. You know, they're just like guys. They take off and they get lost and don't ask for directions, right? So that's one of the typical things. But the other part of a misconception is it only takes one sperm. Well, sort of. But remember, it's kind of like fighting a war. Remember in the Napoleon days, if you got the king, you could have won the war. But it took hundreds and thousands of men to get to the king, so to speak. Well, it takes hundreds of thousands of sperm to get to the egg, and it takes several of these sperm working at the surrounding cells of the egg to penetrate the egg. So that's something that's real important. And it's not really a woman's thing where she really is a shopper. So that egg's looking for the best sperm out of 50 million sperm.
And so in terms of things that we can do to overall improve your spontaneous fertility, we had touched on it a little bit before about certain lifestyle factors. Certainly, we would want to eliminate smoking, any kind of illicit drug use, which may affect male, even possibly female fertility. We want to have modest or minimal caffeine intake for the woman especially. It's important to look at the history as well, too. For instance, if someone's had a past history of very painful periods, and they've gone through laparoscopy and been found to have endometriosis, this is certainly something that can impact not only the periods, but also fertility. Certain medications for women or men can influence fertility, so we have to be careful about what medications you are on. And so there are multiple factors in the history alone that can really start leading us into knowing what to target and counsel patients in terms of what they should be minimizing or eliminating.
One of the popular recreational drugs is marijuana, and the compound in marijuana actually changes the hormonal levels in men, and women too, but in men, which is more detrimental. It lowers testosterone production. It increases the estrogen production. Yeah, that's right for all of those men out there. We actually do make some estrogen. I know we'll never admit it, but we do, just like women make a little bit of testosterone. But anyway, that ratio is very important for the production of sperm. So actually, in heavy marijuana use, the testosterone level can drop enough that the sperm production goes down. Actually, there can be a little bit of breast development from that. So this is something that clearly should be avoided. It sort of slams the sperm count. The other thing, too, as Natalie brought up about caffeine, it seems that the best guideline is not to exceed 100 to 200 milligrams of caffeine a day for the woman. And that would be like an English teacup of caffeine, of coffee. And tea in that would have about 50 milligrams, a cola maybe 40. And remember, it can't be like a one of these specialty places where the caffeine is doubled. So keep that in mind. That's very important. And there is some data suggesting that once you do conceive, that the chance of miscarriage can be a little bit higher in women who consume a lot of caffeine.
That's important to know, because a lot of people come and say, oh, I have one cup of coffee a day, but you find out it's about 16 ounces, which is basically double the size of a regular cup of coffee. So pay attention to how much caffeine you're getting, whether it be from coffee, tea, sodas, or even these energy drinks, which I don't even know how much caffeine they have, but I'm sure they have buku amounts. So just to be aware that a modest or minimal amount of caffeine intake for the woman is recommended for fertility purposes.
I think a couple other things. One is for women who drink a little bit of alcohol, it's important not to drink at all after ovulation. After all, we consider you pregnant. And leading up to that, alcohol intake should be modest. And it seems that probably it should not exceed a drink every day or every other day. So kind of keep that in mind. Remember, healthy lifestyles will make this much easier for you. And there is a little bit that you can do, although seeking help is the best thing to do.
And again, seeking help does not mean you're going to definitely do IVF. There are a whole wealth of possible treatments and options that we have to consider. It really does depend upon the individual couple and what are the factors that are playing a part in terms of the infertility. So,
thank you so much for being here this hour on 1370. Remember, more information you can obtain from txfertility.com. We'll be back next week on Saturday at this time for more of Beyond the Birds and the Bees.